This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a real pleasure to welcome back to the program Dr. Fred Poston, who is wearing a different administrative hat than the last time we talked. Back in January, Fred was named Dean, College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, and Special Advisor to the President. After serving several years as MSU's Vice President for Finance and Operations, Fred, it's a different job, but certainly not a new one.
No, it's not. I think some of my friends have told me, says, well, maybe you get it right this time.
But for our listeners who may not know, it was 7 or 8 years formerly as dean?
Yeah, almost about 7.5 years, and then 14 as vice president. And the college was having some difficulties, and the search didn't yield the person that everybody was excited about. And so at that point, I volunteered to come back if they wanted me. And President Simon looked at the college and looked at that and said, well, we better. So away we went.
Well, the reception from what I hear out in the countryside has been most positive, having you back at the helm.
Yeah, I've been telling folks. I said, you know, you seem a whole lot more excited about me coming back than you were upset when I left.
Well, Fred, since January, you've hit the ground running. Now, one thing that you're doing, you and your leadership team have been out and about in the state listening to what folks have to say about the college.
Right, Kirk. I think, you know, two or three things. One, that 14-year gap. I really sort of have a blind spot because I was just totally focused on the campus, and this thing never goes to sleep, so it takes your undivided attention. So I really was not aware of where agriculture was or what the issues were with people. And so it looked to me like a good opportunity to go around and visit with folks and just mostly hear what they wanted to say and see what their issues were. And we've done, I believe, about 5 of the 13 we intend to do, and they're pretty successful.
I know you're about halfway through the process, Fred, but anything that stands out thus far from what you've been hearing?
Well, I would have anticipated I would have had a lot of complaints about extension because of the radical changes that Tom Coombe had to make to be able to keep everything afloat. But surprisingly, there are quite a few questions, but nothing too horrible if you're in terms of feelings and the rest. A lot of questions about enrollment and who's coming to MSU and Michigan students and various things. A lot of questions about those. A lot of questions about research, wondering where the college and the university are headed. And a lot of discussion about that. There were no big things that were surprises. There were smaller things that crop up, things that this one cropped up actually before, but I was up at the Orchard Show in Traverse City, and one gentleman in the back stood up and said very kindly that he was in part of the weather system that we have, and he said, you know, he didn't mind buying the hardware, and he didn't even really mind paying the communication costs, but it was upsetting to him. He had to pay for the data that came back. I remember telling him I thought that was pretty cheeky. We got that fixed. So,
yeah, here I am participating and creating the data, and I got to pay for it to get it
right.
Back. Yeah.
That just was a little much. So, but there are things like that have happened, and you just have to go back and sort the pieces out. Nobody was trying to do something horrible, but they were just barely scraping by after the cut. So,
well, one thing you may be hearing about, and I know you're involved with it as well, governor's put a big push on food processing expansion in the state of Michigan. That's been an issue, as you know, in Michigan for a long time. You're probably hearing some of that out there. But what's the College of Ag and Natural Resources doing with respect to helping to expand our food processing capability?
Well, I sort of walked through the door, and this one was in process, so to speak. We very quickly looked and said, okay, where could the university help in this initiative? And because we can't do everything, but there are some things we can do. One of the things that was that people were saying we needed, and some of the surveys at least would seem to back it up, is that we have a workforce shortage problem. of people that can run these processing facilities. As it just so happens, years ago, Ian Gray and I helped a Northern Ireland university establish essentially a degree program. They had a two-year program, and guess what their two-year program was? It was, and they trained some of the best people to manage food processing facilities all over Europe. So we, in fact, I had dinner with Irish last night talking about that, and they were more than willing to help us and send some people that would help us formulate that. I think we can formulate a two-year program in our ag tech programs that'll meet the needs. I'd like to try and do it with some community colleges. This will be a challenge because to teach, there's a lot of very expensive equipment that traditionally you have to have your hands on. But I think there's some ways maybe around that. And if we can work with our community college partners, we'll see if we can't sort those pieces out.
I'm talking with Fred Poston, who's the Dean of the College of Ag and Natural Resources.
You're listening to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Your host is Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Fred, we were talking about expanding food processing in Michigan, so let's continue where we left off.
There is a need for existing processors. We're not talking about the multinational processors. We're talking about the smaller and intermediate-sized ones. To have a facility they can rent part of as they're developing a new product line, because they have their space and their existing product lines dedicated to trying to make money, which is what they're going to use to finance the expansion. So they really can't shut it down. And so there are some plans afoot, possibly with some federal help, to see if we couldn't develop a center like that. And the third area we said that we could help in was technical assistance. You know, if you're a small processor and you're as I've told the story, and you're out away from the big cities one place and another, and you can't get the goop out of the mold, your long-term research needs really don't come into play at that point. you need help. Yeah, yeah. And as it so happens, we have about four or five packaging and food scientists that have retired in recent years that were just phenomenal at helping people. And they said they would be interested in coming back and working with people. So those are the areas I think we could help in. MDARD is the one that's been sort of tagged by the governor to honcho this effort, at least through the government. And I know they've started a grants program. They put out an RFP for it, and people will be applying for grants. So we'll see how all of this develops.
Fred, another area you've often been or long been passionate about is leadership development. And I know you've been spending quite a bit of time, Great Lakes Leadership Academy, trying to raise money and get some of those leadership efforts endowed. A very good program, but it needs stronger financial support.
Well, it really does. Of course, I suppose leadership programs have been around for a long time, but years ago, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation funded Michigan State University, and they started a program for farmers. Intensive program. It made a huge difference in leadership development for each of those individuals. And in fact, when I first came here, many of the larger commodity groups and legislators and others that were products of that program, since MSU started it, we were the first, we made a fundamental mistake. We didn't attempt to endow it. The irony of it is when I left Washington State University many years ago, we just finished off the endowment for the leadership program that we copied from Michigan State University. So the university hit hard times, and the Kellogg money was really to start up, not to run forever. We didn't have the funding for it, and it was shut down. This is before I ever became dean. And true to form, we have a gap in leadership in the state. So I was really pleased to see that in my absence, had nothing to do with it. Powers that be started it up again, and this time Vicky Ponce is leading that. They have a goal trying to reach about $3 million to endow the piece to it. I said, let's don't miss this opportunity this time. Let's get this done. And it's an investment in the state long term.
And a difference in these leadership programs, Fred, correct me if I'm wrong, but the focus is not solely on the agricultural sector. There's an integration of natural resources, agriculture, and others.
Absolutely correct. And there's huge strength in that. And in reality, agriculture is a part of everyday society. It needs to not be separate. It needs to be integrated. And participants in those programs, there are large farmers in there, there are inner city activists in there, there are inner city and just very, you know, race diversity, male, female, gender diversity, and really cultural diversity from, and it's just a tremendous growth experience.
I had an opportunity to interact with some of those people, but it culminates, and you and I both know from our own personal experience, the capstone experience is an international one,
right,
which really opens up the eyes of those folks to what's going on globally.
Yeah, we saw this years ago when you were running the department and I was dean, that we cranked up those overseas study programs, and we saw what a huge difference it made in those undergraduate students. It really took them out of their comfort zone. And it's always amazed me how much easier it is to see other people's problems than your own.
Right.
But when you compare and contrast, it gives you quite a vision of your own problems. The same thing happens when you put these folks through the leadership program. Exactly the same. And it has a profound impact on them.
Fred, another thing, too, you're working on an initiative, I know, hand in glove with the Michigan livestock industry, to essentially fund research projects that are going to be of short and long-term benefit to the industry. I know that's just in the embryonic stages, but tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things, the Animal Initiative was one of the first legislative products that I had a chance to work on in Michigan, and that was already designed when I got here. And then we put the plant initiative together, Project Green. And Project Green has been one of the most successful projects around the country. A lot of people have copied it. We put some things into Project Green that we tried that worked famously that were not in the Animal Initiative. And a lot of our relationships and our research has suffered because of it, principally in Project Green. The commodity groups and the researchers, the administrators get together each year on each of those commodities and argue out the priorities. And argue sometimes is the operative word. It's not always pleasant, but we learned that it was far better to work that out right there at that time and keep things focused on what everybody agreed to. We didn't have that kind of a process in the Animal Initiative. So we still had $350,000 of operating dollars we kept separate. We pulled that, and I challenged the experiment station to come up with another $500,000 to get us started. And Doug Bueller, who's the chair of Ag Bio Research or the director of it, is working with the livestock commodity groups to fundamentally put this in place. They have to put money on the table, too, to be able to participate and leverage, you know, more money out of it, which gives them a vested interest in the outcome.
Yeah.
And that keeps us together.
And I think with the plan, with Project Green, that was part and parcel of the success, that everybody has a stake in the outcome.
Right. And everybody took credit for it and owned it, and good or bad.
Fred, again, you're back in as the dean of the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. We talked about leadership development. We've talked about a new initiative in the animal area. Are there other things on the horizon that you're going to be dealing with as we look down the trail?
Well, after the various problems we went through at the university and the massive cuts and one thing and another and the difficulties in the field, you know, there are a lot of things that are sort of out of place in the college that have to be tended to and put back together in some appropriate form. We've been doing a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I was a football coach, I'd be saying, well, we're going to have a period of back to basics, kind of. Here's how everything works. Get people back in, you know, in tow and together and that seems to be happening. We've got a really good faculty, a lot of, as I say, the old dogs that helped us climbed to the top before are still here. Mm-hmm. They're getting a little long in the tooth like me, but they still got it. And one of the things they did do that was right in the college, they just hired some exceptional young faculty. The two of us probably wouldn't qualify.
That's right. We might not be here. Well, Fred, it's great to have you back as the Dean of the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. Again, the word I hear out there in the countryside, a lot of optimism about where the college is headed. People want to go to the listening sessions. I guess for more information on where these listening sessions are, go to the CANR website, and they're listed right there.
Exactly.
Yeah. My guest has been Fred Poston, Dean of the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources and Special Advisor to the President. Thanks, Fred.
Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Here's Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with Big Ten Commissioner Jim Delaney.
25 years. Doesn't seem that long, but man, have you accomplished a lot in those 25 years. Can you reflect a little bit on maybe some of the achievements, some of the great things like the Big Ten Network and others that have come along?
You know, it's been a privilege, an opportunity and a privilege to work for these great universities. I'm not a Big Ten by birth. I'm from the East and went to school in the ACC. But, you know, to have an opportunity to work with educational leaders, athletic leaders, great coaches, and the commitment that we have to the broad-based programs has just been a fun thing, I guess is the best way to say it. But, you know, change is ever present. We've expanded. We've built a network. We've kept faith, I think, with the athlete. We've expanded the not only the opportunities for women, but also kept those that we have for the men intact. And so it seems like the job changes every 5 years with the challenges and the people. I've been blessed with some energy and some health, but mostly blessed with the opportunity to work with great people and great universities.
Not only a student at North Carolina, you were on the basketball team, captain. Went to two Final Fours. Your experiences as a student athlete and what you're seeing today, can you even reflect on the comparison?
You know, what's interesting is 18-year-olds are 18-year-olds. We all make mistakes. We're all kids. We're all learning, young men, you know, trying to make it to the next stage of life. Kids compete hard then. They compete hard now. There's no doubt that because of specialization and early training, the level of maturity physically as well as skills is far greater than it was. It probably changes every 10 or 15 years. So that's been fun to watch. I also think that, you know, 40 years ago when you went, you really understood the connection intuitively between the scholarship, the education, the competition. It wasn't taken for granted. It was an opportunity. My father was a teacher. We had five kids in our family. I wouldn't have had that opportunity if it wasn't for the scholarship. And so that still resonates with me today. And so to the extent that I see, you know, and we played in front of full houses. We played every game on television. It wasn't like we were chopped meat. There was some interest in what we were doing. Now, the dollars, there were probably a couple extra zeros now. But just because you're successful commercially doesn't mean you're professional. We're still about education. We need to do a better job of reconnecting to education. And I think we had $15 a month back in the late 60s, and that plus the $15 I got from home, you know, was pretty significant. Now, I think we need to get the miscellaneous expense right. I think we need to commit to the at-risk student to make sure they have the resources they need to succeed. To do that, we probably need to address the time demands. And lastly, if young people take some time off or pursue things professionally, I think our commitment should be for more than 4 years. And so if we stay connected to the education and stay connected to the experience of the athlete, I think we've got a bright future. If we fail to do that, it's on us.
one of the things growing up in the Midwest, you always have points of passion. And when I took the job, one of the statements I made is we will not rest until we enter each season expecting that season to end with the paint of roses on our cleats. Yeah. It's the Rose Bowl. It's the 100th Rose Bowl coming up this year. It's part of our heritage and part of our structure. Can you maybe share with folks in Michigan and across the Midwest where we're headed as a league and maybe nationally where we're headed, not only with the Rose Bowl, but with our bowl coalition, as well as what's happening with the BCS and the playoff structure?
Well, Mark, as you know, this is the 100th game. It's also the last national championship game, BCS, in the Rose Bowl. Next year will be the first semifinal game in the new college football playoff structure. So I'm really pleased that we're able to keep the playoff structure inside the construct of the bowl system. I'm really glad that the Rose Bowl maintains its relevance and its position relative to the other bowls. We were able to strike with our some existing bowl partners and new bowl partners. We spent a lot of time with our athletic directors and coaches thinking about how to do the next cycle. And, you know, I was really pleased with where that came out so that we have really four destinations in Florida, Miami, Jacksonville, Orlando, and Tampa. We have two in Texas, Fort Worth and Dallas. We have three in California, San Diego, Pasadena, and San Francisco. We have a regional bowl here in Detroit. We've got a game in New York City, and we have a game in Nashville. So I think there's going to be tremendous opportunities. This is where our alumni live in many cases. This is where our coaches recruit. These are not exclusively warm weather, but they're predominantly warm weather, so there's going to be a lot of treats for a lot of teams. The key for us was be national and also keep it fresh, so that our fans and our players and our coaches have new experience. So, you know, I really thought it was a home run. I thought we had the best slate last time. I think we have even a better slate this time. And I think others improved. Some others didn't do as well. But for the next 6 years, we have that. We also have the Rose Bowl, eight of the next 12 years. And then, of course, we doubled the number of teams that have an opportunity to play for the brass ring through a 1-4-2-3 playoff system embedded in the bowl. So I think that the regular season is still the key, and I think our postseason has grown a bit, but I think it's done so in a way to provide more opportunities and still keeping the greatest regular season in college sports.
I think when you talk about the bowl structure and you look at a couple that we've added on with San Francisco, San Diego, you combine that with the Rose Bowl, and you talk about the demographics of Big Ten graduates, Big Ten alums. Now you turn to expansion, and you look at what we're doing in the East. You look at Rutgers, Maryland, what we've already done with Nebraska and Penn State. But that Eastern Corridor, again, not only for Michigan State, but for Michigan and others that are in the Big Ten, very strong alumni base. Sure, it helps our television penetration, but I also think it's an opportunity for us to really expose our brand, our teams, where Big Ten alums are really gathered and really turn into a positive event.
I think so. It's going to be challenging. It's a new area for us, but we have close to a million alums living there. They're all married to someone. Most of them have kids. So, you know, you multiply it by 3.5 or 4, and it's really a significant presence. They know there's awareness about the Big Ten, but I think when our teams, when Michigan, Michigan State, Ohio State, Penn State come over the little mountains there, play some football, play some basketball, get to the iconic venues, whether it's the Garden or Yankee Stadium, MetLife, it's going to be good. There's nothing good that's not challenging. There's nothing good that doesn't have some risk. But I think it's incumbent upon us to take advantage of those opportunities, both flagship public AAU institutions in contiguous territories. And the reality is that conferences have gotten larger. All the major conferences are now in two regions. We all have a challenge to build brand, build relationships, make friends. And we're intent on doing that. And I think we can be successful. We only added really 3% to our geographic mass and 30% to our demographic. And so there's lots of competition. It's probably the most dense corridor. It's probably the most competitive corridor. It's got great high schools, great financial and political institutions, great media interests. But if you could just be relevant, if you could just be impactful, there's an awful lot to gain. The Yankees are the Yankees and the Giants are the Giants, and they will always be the dominant influences. But we're in other pro markets in our region, and we find a way to comfortably have an impact and be relevant, and I'm hopeful and confident that over time we'll be able to achieve that.
When you look at great leaders, what I always say is one vision. It's being able to forecast into the future, and then it's assembling people around you to execute a plan to attack or approach that future. As you look at our past and you reflect on many of the successes that you had, I think the implementation of instant replay is one that perhaps gets overlooked, but at the same time has made a dramatic impact. You look at the Big Ten Network, which many naysayers were there during that process, but has proven to be one of the greatest assets of not only the league, but its member institutions, building us to 10,000 student athletes and $150 million in scholarships annually. You look at all these things, and those are just a few examples. What's out there on the horizon? Where are we headed? What do you see happening in college sports in the Big Ten Conference in the future?
You know, we've had some success, and there's a lot of fingerprints on that success. You don't do the kinds of things we've done without, you know, willing partners, and that's athletic directors, that's football and basketball coaches, presidents, and you do it for a reason. You need the resources necessary to support these broad-based programs. So I think we know why we're doing it, and I think we know how to do it, and certainly I think the risks we've taken have been reasonable risks in the context of the environment. Going forward, I think a major challenge we have is to identify the weaknesses in the system. And I think I tried to articulate a couple of them earlier. We're going to need some help internally from our coaches. We're going to need some leadership by our athletic directors and presidents, because we need to assure a high level of success for every student that comes here. I think we're going to continually be challenged to develop resources to sponsor these broad-based programs. I don't want to see anything cut. I don't want the experiences to be anything less than the high quality they are today. I do think that some of the regulations we have at the national level restrain our ability to do what we should be doing and what we can afford to do for athletes. It doesn't mean that we have an unlimited amount of money, but we can prioritize the revenues we do have to make sure that we can address the shortfalls. So I think it's about visioning a fair deal, one that's connects the athlete to the education for the duration, and then getting a system, a governance system that allows us to execute on that. If we get the change in the governance system and fail to execute on it, well, shame on us, because you know, that's something that we need to do. There are critics, and some of them are fair critics. We're not perfect. There are weaknesses in the system. But I fully believe in the educational base system. I fully believe in the scholarship, and I believe that it's appropriate for us not to rely on institutional funding except as a very last resort. We want to be able to stand on our own 2 feet to do so in a way to provide equitable opportunities for men and women. And it's a challenge. We've been fortunate in the last 10 or 12 years, but people forget that in the middle 90s, things weren't as good. In the late 80s, we've been able to grow interest, grow support, I think do it in the right way, but I think there are weaknesses, and I think we ought to address those in the future years.
Over the past 25 years, you've made such a positive impact, I think, in individuals that have been in positions of president, athletic directors, coaches. It's been a blessing for me to be able to sit at a table and continue to sit at a table, learning from you, advising with you, and collaborating. But most importantly, and I don't think this should ever go unnoticed, it's the positive impact you have on the many student athletes, the decisions that you make every year and every day that makes it possible for us at the institution to be able to provide the services that we provide at such a high level. So, you know, with that, we're so grateful that you joined us today, but also grateful for the impact that you have on so many people.
Thank you, Mark. Like I said, it's been a privilege and an opportunity, and it's a team effort, and you know, I've just felt great and continue to be energized. There are more projects to do, and I know you're a project guy, an event guy. I'm a project guy and an event guy, and we'll continue to do them together.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
That was Big Ten Commissioner Jim Delaney talking with Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear their conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association, the world's largest organization of Spartans helping Spartans. Wherever your Spartan life takes you, you're never far away from an MSU Alumni Association member who shares our dedication to community, connections, careers, and class. Help us expand the worldwide Spartan Nation. Join the MSU Alumni Association today at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, a couple weeks ago, I was able to spend a very pleasant afternoon walking around downtown Traverse City, and I happened to walk into a delightful and newly opened brew pub. The brew pub is the Workshop Brewing Company, and there I met owner Pete Kirkwood, who shared with me some of the things he has done and hopes to do regarding green business practices. Pete's on the other end of my line to tell us more. Pete, nice to talk to you again.
Thanks, Kirk. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about why you got into the Workshop Brewing Company, how it all started.
This is my second brewing venture, actually. I started my first one as Shawnee Craft Brewing Company in northeastern Pennsylvania about 4.5 years ago. So I sort of understand how the business works. My family connection to this area is the reason why I'm here. My grandparents are from Frankfort, which is about an hour west of us here in Traverse City. I spent my whole life coming to this community and watching it over the last decade or so, just blossoming into such an appealing place that Traverse City, when we decided it was time to kind of try a change of scene, my wife and my kids and I, Traverse City just became so compellingly appealing that it was just the place to be. And with the food and drink scene that's just blossoming up here, and with people that shared our values when it comes to things like environmental protection and community, it got to be too appealing to resist.
Yeah, it's amazing, and you know this better than I, Pete, but in the last couple of years, major magazines across the country, not just food magazines, but tourism and destination magazines, Traverse City has become not just a regional destination, but now a national destination.
That's definitely true. This is, my wife and I have connections to a lot of different great places, and we were surprised ourselves when Traverse City kept moving to the top of our list of places that we wanted to be. And now that we're here, we really are not looking back. One of the wonderful things about Traverse City is that we're blessed not only with amazing natural beauty and a great community, we're also blessed with a really harsh winter, which is a natural kind of regulator on how much development happens up here and how many people move here, because you really have to be committed to make it through the winter. You know what I mean? We love it, but you do have to be committed.
You have to be committed, and that gives the area a little bit of downtime, except for those winter sports enthusiasts who really do like harsh winters. But one thing you told me when we were talking, and by the way, your brew is excellent. I will say that ahead of this, but you are committed to zero waste.
Yeah, we are. I mean, it's consistent with our philosophy. Our business philosophy is summed up really in three words, and that's nature, community, craft. I could elaborate ad nauseum on those things, but really we feel like these things really interconnect with each other. A commitment to our community interconnects with our commitment to the environment, interconnects with our commitment to the craft. In this is a great little microcosm of that. We make beers, beautiful beers, the best beers that hands can make, out of organic grain. We've never made a beer out of that's any less than something like 93% organic ingredient by weight. So, and not including the water, of course, but, when we're really proud of that, and when it's not organic, it's basically because we couldn't source the ingredient we needed that way, or because we sourced it locally and not organically. But once we're finished brewing a batch of beer, the spent grain, this, substantial weight of moist barley, which is, it is not useful for beer anymore, but still has a lot of nutritional value. There's a local farmer here that comes and picks it all up and uses it for fodder for his livestock. We think that's great because we're making something that's an amazing craft item, and we're putting it back into the natural ecosystem as a food stock, and we're supporting our community because we're helping a local farmer to run his business, and then that's the guy who comes to the farmer's market and produces whatever stuff that the rest of the community enjoys. One of our beers contains a big charge of local honey, and that's another great opportunity for us to support another local business in this kind of self-reinforcing cycle of nature, community, and craft.
Yeah, that the buying local phenomenon, and you're right in the middle of that, and you're obviously bought into that. But that Traverse City has been making some amazing strides in the schools, in businesses like yours across the region. Buying local is huge.
I think, yeah, it really is, and that appeals to us a lot. I mean, when I first heard about, started thinking about the local food movement, I thought it was this kind of effete, elitist thing that, people will spend lots of extra money to buy this fancy food that's really indistinguishable from supermarket food. And the more I kind of got into it, the less I think that's true, because, first of all, I think it's empirically more pleasant to consume this food. And secondly, I think when you talk about the economics, you're missing out. I mean, people typically miss out on a really significant piece of the upside, which is the way that money spent in your community reverberates, and in ways that aren't only economic, in ways that are also sort of social and community. Like if you have someone, let's say a blacksmith who works in your town, okay? And you tell anybody that, they think that's awesome. How great is it that there's a blacksmith working in your town? You ask any of them how often they bought a hinge from the blacksmith and how often they bought a hinge from Home Depot, and you know what the answer is. And the thing is, having a blacksmith or a cheesemaker or a brewer or whatever in your neighborhood adds adds appeal and awesomeness to your life that is very, very difficult to quantify in economic terms.
That's an excellent point. I'm talking with Pete Kirkwood, who is the owner of the Workshop Brewing Company in lovely Traverse City. Pete, you mentioned, too, you've only been open for a month, but you've got some other sustainability and green practices in mind that you're going to implement down the trail. What are some of those?
Well, we really are. One of the things that I should have elaborated on when you mentioned the zero waste thing is that my employees just spontaneously basically bestowed that on me. I happened to miss the meeting when we talked to our waste management people, and I came back I got into the brewery, and they said, hey, by the way, we don't have any garbage cans. And I was like, what? And they said, yeah, everything is either recycled, composted, or reused. So that's really wonderful, and that's something that we're committed to. I think, and it's really not that hard, and in fact, I think it's going to end up saving us money. Another thing that I had elaborated on earlier is this composting of our spent grain. Our brew house is an entirely electric brew house. The reason I like that is it frees us up to try to source sustainable energy alternatives. It doesn't commit us to a fossil fuel-based heat source here. Another and in many ways easier way to approach the sustainability thing is to try to do things like solar preheating of hot water, which is something I haven't done yet, and which is something I'm really looking for help on figuring out the financing and the engineering of. But, brewing is a lot about moving hot and cold from one place to another and about heating up a whole lot of fluids, And to the extent that we can use solar preheating on the big flat roof we have here on the building, I really want to do that. And like you said, we just opened, and so at this point I'm really sort of establishing my baseline of electrical and utility consumptions, but I'm really looking forward to addressing in really quantifiable ways how we can make that more efficient, less impactful, and just, better all around.
Well, Pete, 1 month opened, excellent brew. I can testify to that firsthand. You certainly part and parcel of the wonderful Traverse City sustainability ethos, but let me be the first to congratulate you on the opening of the Workshop Brewing Company and just encourage our listeners who happen to be up in the Traverse City area to stop by.
Hey, thank you so much for letting giving me this chance to talk about it. And I just want to give a shout out to my fantastic employees, my great brewer, my great manager, and my wonderful chef. Come on up and try our food, try our beer, and get to know our people.
And for folks who may not know downtown Traverse City, how would you describe your location? It's right near downtown, but are you in the Warehouse District?
That's right. We're in the Warehouse District. It's a 3.5-minute walk from the heart of Front Street, and once you get here, you'll love it because it's so close, but it feels like you really went somewhere. We're between Front Street and the Bay, right across from the open space in Traverse City.
Okay, my guest is Pete Kirkwood, owner of the Workshop Brewing Company in Traverse City. You know, Pete, let's touch base maybe a year or so down the road and see how you're doing with some of these other green initiatives, and congratulations on your new business.
Thanks, Kirk. I look forward to doing that over a glass of beer and a fine sandwich.
You're listening to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Your host is Dr. Kirk Heinze.
My wife Kath and I were recently up in the Grand Rapids area spending some time with our 16-month-old granddaughter, and we decided to take her to the Critter Barn near Zeeland, where I reconnected with a very old and good friend, Mary Rotschafer, who is the director and founder of the Critter Barn, a wonderful educational venue that combines two of Michigan's three largest economic sectors, tourism and agriculture. Mary, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Kirk. Nice to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the Critter Barn.
The Critter Barn actually started by a practical joke that was played on my husband and I. We moved to the homestead of a dairy farm that had been about a 90-acre dairy farm. We had purchased a 3-acre slice to just sort of live out in the country happy forever, right? And right. Just away from urban. And for the purpose of having a bigger garden. And a church choir that I was directing at the time played a joke on us, painted and scraped and painted the entire gambrel roof barn in 3 hours ahead of party time, which wasn't quite the party they told us was planned. And then a whole group of friends from the church, about 200 people, came, and after a pig roast, they put on a show. And there were skits about me being pregnant, and of course the punchlines, Mary had a little lamb, and the kids' choir sang Old MacDonald Had a Farm, and there were pig in the blankets, and literally, and so, not the pastry with the sausage, right, but the piggy with the blanket. Anyway, that little hobby farm startup, about 6 years later, friends, relatives, whatever, there's some connections with education because I used to teach third and fourth grade at Holland Christian in Holland. And people asked if I could just put together a school field trip for their children. And they go, come on, Mary, you used to teach school. You can put something together. The majority of the two buildings that were left from the dairy farm were being used for boat and trailer storage. The dairy farm had moved out about 10 years prior to when we purchased the farm. And so we just had animals in one wing. That's kind of how we got started. Now, 23 years later, about 70,000 people a year, both at the site and off-site when we take the farm to events, festivals, church picnics, company picnics, things like that. So we've found that that little startup, there's been quite a need, and we've developed now very intentionally a lot of educational programs to not only invite people in just for the fun of walking around, but to also learn about agriculture.
Well, I can testify personally. I mean, you do have an educational foundation to virtually all that you do, and that must come from your background as a teacher and your work in the community.
That's exactly right, Kirk. And now I look at myself, you know, when you look over your shoulder, you see there's a tremendous passion for education, and education, learning, is springboard to life. I mean, it just feeds us. It's who we are. We want to learn more. And it's always exciting, even when folks your age come to the farm and are introduced to things that they've never had straight in their mind their entire life. A lot of people don't understand how eggs develop and the role of the yolk versus the role of the umbilical cord in the mammal. And simple things that people who have grown up in agriculture take for granted, but the common folks like me, and I didn't know all this either when I grew up, it was all foreign to me. So as it was exciting for me to learn, and as we built relationships really out of a need to know what to do with veterinarians and the folks that we got animals from, we now are so networked and connected to just dozens and dozens of people in the agricultural world. They've really helped to bring quality to the farm and to what we do. And those relationships are helping us move along now as we are a nonprofit entity and work to not only teach about ag, but bless children from lower economic backgrounds, kids with special needs, and so on. There's a lot of offshoots now of the farm. So,
well, I took a look at your sponsors page on your really excellent website, I must say, and the number of sponsors impressive. And not all of your sponsors are from agriculture per se.
That's correct. There's a lot of folks that just love it that you're doing something for kids. We've had free public admission for 2 years now. And that would be my goal, to maintain that so that everyone can come. And as a nonprofit, as a charitable organization, I think that's a posture that we wanted to get to. And we took a leap of faith, and we've got a donation box by the back door, and we just tell folks it takes about $700-$800 to run the farm every day, literally, with staffing and all your utilities and feed costs and maintenance. And, you know, we're glad you're here. If you can support us, please do. And it just works. Not that we don't have more fundraising to do, but that slice, we're doing better than what we did on ticket sales a couple years ago. And so many more people come. Yeah. And there's so many people that will look at us. In fact, I've got a gal who's an administrative professional from Grand Valley who volunteers at our farm once a week. And that's the reason she's there, because it just goes with her heart that we have something that everybody can come to that's free, because she'll have people come up to her and say, thank you so much for having this available. And then they'll put $2, $3, $4 in the box. And you know that from some families, that's like a $50 bill to them. And it doesn't matter. I'm just glad they're there. And so, yeah, it's just growing by leaps and bounds, and we're thrilled.
My guest is Mary Rotschafer, who is the director and founder of the Critter Barn. One thing I noticed when we were there recently, Mary, was you did have an awful lot of people who were there to help the guests, and young people, people of all ages. I mean, how much of the volunteer thing, I mean, it must be essential to the operation of the Critter Barn.
Absolutely. And you saw dozens of people. We have a class, actually, it's called Critter Camp, which prepares kids age 8 to 16 to volunteer at our farm. And if they want to just take the class and learn about the animals and the operations of the farm, they can stop at that point. But it is a prerequisite for volunteering. So we have anytime 250 to 300 children that are on the active roster to volunteer. We've added some enrichment programs because some of them have been with us for a long time, and doing more like an FFA project. So that's been exciting this summer. We also have a lot of adults volunteer, people in education, folks that just care about kids and want to help. There's some senior citizens that come every week. Got a gentleman, Jim, who's 85 years old. He's there every Monday morning. So it's a wonderful blend. And for many of these kids, the Critter Barn has been their family farm. And they are really good at watching the animals, sensing when someone is not quite up to par, better than a hired adult who I might bring in to join our staff, because they've been there and they've been watching it for so long. So those are volunteers that share information. They know the farm. They speak with confidence. And in a sense, Kurt, we're growing up kids, too, to have responsibility to build their own self-esteem. Because when they volunteer and talk to guests and share information, coach each other, support each other, it's just another wonderful network of social skills and stuff that builds those kids up. So,
well, the Critter Barn recently had a major announcement, big news. You folks are in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Yeah, we're working on it. Guinness World Records Limited contacted us and said, we understand you have a very elderly pig. And if he lives beyond midnight on July 19, he will be the oldest pig on record. So we are now pursuing the paperwork and photographs. In fact, you have a newsletter in your hand, and that
Mr.
picture,
Chops.
Yeah, that picture's on our website. And he is the oldest pig on record now, 21 years and over 60 days.
Wow.
And so that's exciting, too.
Well, Mary, yeah, we got a little bit of time left, but talk to us about, let our listeners know about a few of the major events coming up in the fall.
Sure, sure. We're located in Zeeland, which is near Holland, Grand Rapids. We're right off the expressway, very easy. Go to our website, critterbarn.org, and you can find out about these events. We are at the Zeeland Pumpkin Festival, the first weekend in October, with animal displays for 2 days, Saturday and Friday night prior. We have a fundraiser. If you would like to be involved and support our educational efforts and our programming, our outreach, we have an event called the Roundup. It's for adults. It's a dinner, an auction, and a fundraising evening on October 17.
And that website, again, is critterbarn.org. And again, from personal experience, you got to go to the Critter Barn and check it out. It's something there for the whole family, major educational emphasis, links agriculture, tourism, and education. I've been talking with old friend Mary Rotschafer, who is the director and founder of the Critter Barn. Mary, so good to have you on the program.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Kurt. It's nice to be here.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. How many times have you been wearing your Spartan apparel in an airport and a voice in the crowd shouts, "Go Green"? Well, that's happened to me in Beijing, Osaka, Kuala Lumpur, and Mumbai, and even in unlikely places like Ann Arbor and Columbus. There's a special bond we Spartans share, and that's at the foundation of everything we do at the MSU Alumni Association. As the world's largest organization of Spartans helping Spartans, MSUAA truly is your personal network for life. From the moment you join, you've added thousands of fellow Spartans to your personal network, people who will pick up the phone and lend a hand just because you share Michigan State in common. That's the ethic that makes Spartans leaders, lifesavers, and world changers. And that's exactly what you'll find when you become an active member of the MSU Alumni Association. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans A.D. Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.
Doug Bueller leads MSU Ag Bioresearch.
MSU Ag Bioresearch is really located strategically within Michigan State University, and we concentrate on research in agriculture, natural resources, and energy.
MSU Ag Bioresearch is changing the face of science.
Our mission really is wise use of the resources, both human and natural resources, and also to protect the productivity and profitability of our natural resource and agricultural systems.
More than 300 scientists from six MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Well, I think the most important thing we do is to continue to try to develop production systems that can put safe food on our plates, but also protect the environment and also a situation where the producers can make a good living and protect their resources at the same time.
MSU Ag Bioresearch, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.